May it please the court. My brief raises two distinct points relied on, and I would like to discuss both of them today. First, whether the state proved that Mr. Stewart placed T.S. in apprehension of immediate physical injury for purposes of his domestic assault conviction. And second, whether the state proved that Mr. Stewart unlawfully remained in the house for purposes of his burglary and armed criminal action convictions. Now, in point one, I have argued that the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Stewart placed T.S. in apprehension of immediate physical injury. For purposes of this point, section 565.074 is relevant. And that section states that a person commits the crime of domestic assault in the third degree if the person purposefully places such family or household member in apprehension of immediate physical injury by any means. I don't believe this court has analyzed this section. However, the Eastern District Court of Appeals and the Western District Court of Appeals have both determined that statutes containing identical language, specifically the third degree assault statute, present a subjective rather than an objective standard. Specifically, in JDB versus Juvenile Office, the Eastern District Court of Appeals stated that in order to be convicted of assault in the third degree under Subdivision 3, the victim must actually have been placed in apprehension of immediate physical injury. In the present case, the victim, T.S., gave numerous statements during her testimony that she was not afraid of T.S. and that she did not anticipate immediate physical injury. The state is relying primarily on two different statements, one that she was startled when the gun was fired, and two that she was concerned during the encounter. In its brief, the state used the word scared, but it's actually the word concerned. And the question before this court is whether that is enough.
Couldn't circumstantial evidence be used to determine whether someone had a subjective feeling of apprehension?
It absolutely could. And in states like cases like State v. MLS, circumstantial evidence was used. In that case, just like this case, the victim denied essentially being afraid, but the state pointed to other evidence, such as a neighbor testifying that the victim's face was red and that she seemed scared. And then they pointed to the victim's statement to a police officer that she had felt threatened by the defendant. And we don't have anything like that here.
You do have something. If the facts are such that a reasonable person would be apprehensive, doesn't that give rise to an inference that the jury might draw that this person felt apprehensive?
Well, I believe that's the definition of an objective standard. That I think if you can point to the evidence that a reasonable person would be in fear, if that counts as evidence that T.S. was in fear, then we have an objective standard and not a subjective standard.
But I mean, looking at this in the light most favorable to the verdict, couldn't a reasonable juror have inferred that the victim was attempting to avoid injury by her escalation of her voice and repeated telling him to leave, and therefore she must have been in apprehension? Couldn't they have inferred that by those types of circumstances?
Well, she used that language before she ever knew he had a gun.
But she got louder.
She got louder after he fired a gun, and the question is, does that mean she was in fear that he was going to shoot her with that gun, or something else?
And so, looking at this in the light most favorable to the verdict, couldn't a reasonable juror have inferred that?
I don't believe the state proved that beyond a reasonable doubt. And I'm not asking for the equally valid inference rule, but I am saying just asking someone to leave after they fire a gun doesn't mean you were afraid of that person. It would be one thing if he shot at her, but he shot at the ceiling and she asked him to leave, and she testified she was not in fear.
But what does her testimony that she was concerned mean?
So if you look at the full questions, the state asks her, and you testified you didn't know where he was at that point, right? Correct. I'm asking, were you concerned when you heard that gunshot or the glass break that you could have been hit by that bullet? And then she says, I don't know. I don't remember what I felt, I guess. And then the prosecutor says, so your answer is you don't remember. And she says, yeah. So I think if you look at that as a whole, saying she was concerned doesn't rise to the level of apprehension.
Could the jury determine that she was subjectively apprehensive because this person fired a gun in an immediate facility, even though it was at the ceiling?
I think that would be an objective standard rather than a subjective standard. I think you have to look at evidence of what she was feeling. The best evidence for that is her own testimony, but other good evidence would have been had Chad testified, the friend that was in the room, if he had testified as to what she was looking like or what she was doing during this. An officer who spoke with her later could have testified. There are other ways to prove subjective intent, and I don't think you have
so
it
So if someone puts a gun to someone's head and pulls the trigger, and they say, well, I was never scared for my life, then we just got to assume that's the subjective intent?
I think without more, you have to assume that these could have been two friends who messed around, it's not inconceivable that someone would not have been afraid. So I think in that circumstance, and I think that's going to be a very rare case that you have that circumstance, but in that circumstance, you have to reverse the conviction.
Well, the problem is it isn't rare in domestic assault cases. Quite often the victim is not willing to provide testimony for conviction at trial.
Except,
doesn't mean the crime didn't happen.
And that is absolutely right. But in most of those cases, the victim or someone who also observed it would have called the police. So a lot of times you can find another witness. Here, I would say if T.S. had called the police after Mr. Stewart left, then there would be sufficient evidence of subjective intent. But the testimony was she didn't want anyone to call the police and that she didn't call the police. So I think even in a domestic violence scenario where victims are often unwilling to cooperate, you still have sufficient evidence if there is that subjective apprehension.
And the direction to get out isn't by itself sufficient basis to infer that she wanted him to leave because she was afraid of him.
I don't believe so. I think with the earlier statement that she wanted him to leave when he initially came, was knocking on the bedroom door, I think the fact that she continued to want him to leave after he shot into the ceiling doesn't prove she apprehended immediate physical injury.
So is it relevant to a subjective fear what a reasonable person would fear? Is that relevant evidence? I think that's what a lot of the questions are going to. Are there cases that address that, whether the fact that in this kind of circumstance a reasonable person would feel fear, this person said they didn't, it's up to the jury to decide to believe him, but can't they look at the circumstances in making that decision?
I have not found a case that specifically said looking at it from an objective standpoint is one of the factors. And I don't believe it should be under a subjective
standard.
Not
that standard. It has to be, but why can't it be in a particular, like if you did point a gun at someone's head?
And maybe that could be a factor, but I think it has to be coupled with some evidence of the subjective fear. So I don't think it can ever be enough just on its own.
Right.
Moving on to point two, the question here is whether the state proved Mr. Stewart unlawfully remained in the house. I think there are two statutes that are relevant to this question. Section 569.010 states that a person enters or remains unlawfully in or upon premises when he or she is not licensed or privileged to do so. And I think another statute that doesn't come up too often, but Section 556.026 states that no conduct constitutes an offense or infraction unless made so by this code or by applicable statute. Now, in this case, both T.S. and Mr. Stewart testified that they had pulled $5,000 together and entered into a rent-to-own agreement for the house in question. With that testimony, the question is, did the state prove that Mr. Stewart entered the house unlawfully? In other words, once those facts are out there, does the state need to prove he had no ownership interest in the house or license or privilege? And I believe the state needed to prove this once this testimony was out there and that the state failed to do so. The state cites a case from South Dakota, South Dakota versus Pentecost, in the situation where an owner of a house is charged with burglary. Now, I have argued in my brief that this would be creating a statute where one does not exist, but I did want to point out that South Dakota versus Pentecost lists three different factors. And these are not exclusive factors, but it's three factors for determining when a defendant who has an ownership interest in the house has trespassed in the house. The first and these are factors that are cited in several cases in the states that the state cited. First, the defendant's method of entry. Second, the history of past entries. And third, the length of the party's separation. And then they go on to say, and other relevant information. So in this case, there's no indication the defendant entered by any means other than the front door. From all of the evidence, there's a history of past entries where Mr. Stewart was keeping his clothing in the house, eating in the house, using the bathroom of the house.
Is that in the evidence in the light most favorable?
Well, I think when both witnesses testify to that, it would be difficult for this court to ignore. Had the state.
Is your point the fact that they had reached a mutual understanding that he wouldn't stay there at night doesn't mean he didn't have a legal right to be there? Those are different, just like if you have a fight and decide to go live in a hotel for a week, it doesn't mean you don't have a right to be back in your home.
Yes, Your Honor. Especially when the evidence was out there that he had the clothes in the house and that he used the house, and there's nothing to contradict that. The state could have called someone to say, did he have stuff in the house? I think it's pretty apparent he did have possessions still in the house. From all indications, they had only been separated for about a week. And when she
even if he didn't have stuff in the house, if he was legitimately in a rent-to-own situation, why wouldn't he have the right, equal right to be there?
I believe that he would have that equal right, absent an order of protection, a restraining order, a contract preventing him from coming. And I think without those things, he did have a legal right to be there.
Is that what the statute requires, that he not have a legal right to be
well,
there?
Well, the statute requires that he did not have a license or privilege. And those terms are not defined, but I think if you are an owner, you certainly have a privilege to be in the house unless there is something legally preventing you otherwise. And that's why I think the South Dakota case and the other states listed by the state are not relevant in Missouri. I see that my time is up. I ask that you reverse Mr. Stewart's convictions. Thank you.
May it please the court? I'd like to address defendant's second point regarding the sufficiency of burglary first, if I may. Defendant claims that he cannot be convicted of burglary of victim's home as a matter of law, in part because both he and victim had previously contributed financially toward leasing the house. But the plain language of the burglary statute and its associated statutory definitions, which was cited by the appellant counsel, does not exclude owners or co-lessees from potentially violating the statute.
But it does say you have to be not licensed or privileged to remain or enter, right?
Correct, yes.
So the fact that you agreed not to go in because you were having a fight, does that take away your license or privilege to enter?
Well, first of all, I think it matters on how you interpret that agreement. And perhaps there's a contrary inference from that agreement that it was temporary, that it wasn't to the extent that he was living outside the house.
Well, even if it was long-term, I'm just unclear how. And I'm hoping you have an answer to me that if I own my home and my husband and I have a fight and I say, get out of here and don't come back, that doesn't mean he has to get out and can't come back, even if he leaves for a month or 2 months or a week or whatever the point is. How do you jump that gulf from saying the person, even if you said, okay, I won't come back for a month, does that change your privilege or license to come to be there?
I think it could. Now, let me first kind of answer that first part of that is I don't think that, for instance, in this case, the victim could have unilaterally said, get out, lock the doors real quick after he got out, and then not let him back in. It has to be a mutual agreement, and that's what we have in this case. Now, as far as as long as you have a knowing, voluntary, mutual agreement that I am not going to live in the house at this point.
But the mutual agreement let him come into the house.
Well,
under their agreement,
because
his clothes were there and his food was there and so forth.
Okay, well, let me address that then. As far as the possessions, the evidence was that his possessions were in the house. I don't think that was controverted. I think both the victim and the defendant testified to that. However, that doesn't maintain a general right to presence. It might have a limited right to be inside the house to access his possessions, get them, remove them from the house. But let me be clear, that was not the case here. At no point during this incident did he say, I want to talk about, you know, my TV, my
shaving
equipment.
Are you suggesting he unlawfully entered or he unlawfully remained?
Unlawfully remained.
Okay. So
is that because he was invited to bring the firewood in and then overstayed his welcome after she unilaterally said get out?
Well, first, I would quibble with the unilateral aspect. I think there was a mutual agreement that he agreed to leave the house and stay outside in the camper. But yes, I think
why can't he get, explain to me what? Why can't he? Why couldn't he have just changed his mind that regard? What he goes, you know, I told you I would stay out, but I don't have any place to stay, so I'm coming back.
Right.
So you're suggesting that's a burglary. That's an unlawfully remain.
Not necessarily. I don't know that he couldn't come back at some point and say, you know what, I changed my mind. I know before I said, yeah, I'm going to stay out in the camper, but I don't really want to do that anymore. I don't know that he would have been prevented from trying to get that right back. However, that's not the case here. At no point did he try to say exactly that.
Well,
at no point
did he
try to withdraw
that.
So if a husband and wife have a disagreement, and the husband says, I'm going to move out, but he tries to go there when he thinks nobody's there. Is it an unlawful entry case then?
I don't know. I don't know that's not the case here. Now, I'm going to try to address both your question and just this.
Thank you.
Is that, again, there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find that there was a mutual agreement, meaning the defendant agreed when the victim asked him to get out of the house, he said, okay, I will go stay outside in the camper, which is not in the house.
But that doesn't answer my question, which is the fact that you said you'd do that doesn't mean you don't have a legal right to be in it. It just means you agreed you wouldn't do it.
I disagree with that. I think it
does.
Well,
tell me your authority for that under Missouri law.
Well, there is no Missouri law. I think that's why we're here. But the fact that other jurisdictions have addressed this and specifically at site, I think I cited in my brief the Utah case, I think, does a pretty good analysis of this. But the fact that you can, outside of a court order, that you can voluntarily and knowingly relinquish your right to be present in the house. It's up for the jury to decide what the scope of that agreement is, what the scope of that relinquishment
and where
is.
We need some sort of authority rather than just you're saying you think it's a good idea, though. So tell me what the legal rationale is for saying you've given up your right or privilege to be in your own home by saying, okay, I'll leave and I won't come back, but then you change your mind. You have to get permission to change your mind. You're saying, this would really put a lot of people in risk of being incarcerated.
Well, I think that the victim in this case deserves the right to be secure
and an order of protection, of course, takes away any license or privilege, but we didn't have that here.
I'm sorry?
We didn't have an order of protection here,
right,
though, which is just for that purpose and absolutely essential to keeping people safe, but we didn't have that here.
Utah case you cite relies on the concept that one of the persons who has a joint interest in the house relinquishes their possessory interest.
Correct, yes. And in this case, the defendant did so. Or at least there was sufficient evidence for the jury to reasonably find that he did so.
Let's back up a second. I understand your argument that when they had that agreement and he leaves, that he no longer has a right to enter. But you answered Judge Fisher's question that you thought this was an unlawful remaining case rather than an unlawful entry case. So that suggested to me you thought he had a right to enter, that he overstayed. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're correct. I think it's absolutely arguable that in this case that he had a right to enter, but it would be a limited purpose. The evidence was that the victim had called him and said, we're out of firewood. I need firewood to heat the house. He said, okay, I'll bring some firewood by. He comes to the house. He's let in, not by the victim, but by her grandmother and uncle. He delivers the firewood in the basement. He's, by the evidence, done with delivering the firewood. At that point, he says, where's the victim? Oh, she's upstairs sleeping. He goes upstairs, pounds on her door, on her bedroom door,
well,
and at that point they have a confrontation.
He's outside the law now. When he went upstairs, right? Not when she then subsequently told him to leave.
I think that the unlawfully remaining is, I'm not going to say that it's when he's going up the stairs. I think it's after he pounds on her door and says, you know, I want to talk. She says, get out. But he says no. She agrees to come outside and talk to him. At that point, she sees that he has a handgun in his possession, again, tells him to get out of the house, and he sees her overnight guest. And so at that point, instead of getting out of the house, he fires a gun into the ceiling. At that point, I think he's unlawfully remaining.
Well, see, this is why I said before it was unilateral on the part of the victim, and you pushed back on that. Why?
Well, because his limited purpose, his limited right to enter was limited to the delivery of the firewood. It didn't go beyond the firewood. So it was outside of the scope of his privilege to enter the house when he was confronting the victim with the firearm. He was outside of the scope, and then at that point, and that privilege also depends on the victim's privilege or permission at that point. So in that sense, that was unilateral, but only because he had already relinquished his general absolute right to be present inside the house.
What law decides that the other person gets to decide whether someone else has a right or privilege? I mean, you have it under the law. Does somebody else who's not in law enforcement, how do they get to this? And who has no greater legal interest in the property, how do they get to decide if somebody else has a privilege or license to enter?
It's dependent on that mutual agreement. At that point, both of them had paid towards the leasing of the house. Both of them at that point had a privilege to be in the house. He didn't want to agree with the victim to leave, he didn't have to, but he did.
He agreed to leave, but did he agree to give up any legal right or interest?
And I think that was a question for the jury to determine.
Why do you think it's a question for the jury? Why didn't the state have a burden of showing that? Because one doesn't follow from the other.
What doesn't follow from
that? The fact that you agree to leave the house doesn't mean you agree to give up your legal right and interest in the house.
Okay.
So the state would need to present some sort of evidence for that to be a reasonable inference.
Because what he was relinquishing knowingly and voluntarily was living inside the house, was being an occupant of the house. And that's what the burglary statute is designed to protect. It's designed to protect the occupancy, the occupant of the house. He knowingly said, I'm not going to occupy this house anymore. I'm going to be outside in the camper. Now, again, whether that's a temporary or a permanent situation, that's up for the jury to decide. And really what matters is what was the state at the time of the incident. At the time of the incident, there was absolutely no evidence for showing that the defendant, again, tried to take it back and say, you know what, I changed my mind, tried to talk to her and say, won't you let me in the house? None of that. So at that point, his previous agreement to stay, live in the camper outside of the house means that he knew he wasn't living inside the house, and therefore he did not have a license or privilege to be in the house, at least a general right. Every jurisdiction that I've come across, that I've read, has determined that's what the purpose of the burglary statute, the common law purpose, is to protect the occupant's expectation of peace and security in her home. And that expectation was violated here. There was more than sufficient evidence for the jury to find that the defendant was not an occupant of the house at the time of the incident. Both victim and defendant testified that at least 3 days before the incident, she asked him to get out of the house because she had discovered he was cheating on her, which he admitted at trial, and that in response he agreed to leave the house and stay in the camper outside. She repeatedly testified he was not living in the house at the time of the incident. He also similarly testified that he agreed to stay out in the camper, and then in fact, before the incident, he wasn't even on the property except to sleep in the camper at night. He didn't do anything else on the property before the incident. So at the time of the incident, there was sufficient evidence for the jury to reasonably find that he was not an occupant of the house and therefore did not have the general license or privilege to be present inside the house. Now, as far as the possessions and the other evidence, that he continued to eat inside the house, he continued to bathe inside the house, continued to rehab the house, that's evidence that's contrary to the verdict. So it must be disregarded by this court. I think there's good reason to disregard it in addition to just the applicable standard of review. Her testimony when she said that he continued to use the house in that manner, it wasn't clear as to the time frame. There was testimony that throughout 2015, and this the incident occurred in January of 2015, that throughout 2015 he continued to live with her. They had apparently reconciled, so it wasn't clear that she wasn't referring to a period of time after the incident. Certainly what was relevant was the period of time at the time of the incident, right before the time of the incident. And again, his evidence, his testimony was, I wasn't even on the property. So the jury could well have believed, okay, he wasn't using the house at this time, therefore he wasn't an occupant. So that evidence should be disregarded by this court.
Every court that has addressed this issue has accepted the idea of relinquishing a possessory right. And I'm looking at your table of authorities, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 states. Is that how many have addressed this issue?
I really couldn't give a number. I know I cited some cases. I didn't cite every case.
Utah, South Dakota, Delaware, Iowa, New Hampshire, New York, and South Carolina.
South Carolina, yeah. Ohio is another one. Colorado is another one.
Cases,
some of those cases are cited within those cases.
Those cases say that your legal right, your law school property right, is one factor. It's just not dispositive.
Correct, yes.
It's a factor for us in determining sufficiency, or is it a factor for the jury in determining guilt or innocence?
I think it's a factor for the jury to consider, and then this court obviously looks to whether there's sufficient evidence. So I think it would be an evidence that would be contrary to the verdict in this case.
What in the jury instruction suggested to the jury that was their decision?
I'm sorry?
What part of the jury instructions suggest that that's a fact decision for them to make?
The jury was to determine whether or not he had a license or privilege to be in the house. Under that, I think that the jury had to determine.
They were instructed as such?
Yes.
That the definition of unlawful entry or remaining was given the MAI on that. Is that correct?
I believe so. Yes.
There's an MAI that defines unlawful.
It's by statute. It's unlawfully remains is whether you have a license or privilege to do so.
So is it an objective or subjective standard on the first issue?
Thank you. I believe it is a subjective standard. Obviously, this court hasn't addressed that yet, but I have no quibble with the fact that it is a subjective standard. It's purposely placing the victim in apprehension. But certainly that standard was met in this case on a number of different pieces of evidence. They alluded to it. One, the victim testified that she was, in fact, startled during the first shot, that she was aware that could do some damage, and that at the time of the second shot, and there was some in the reply brief, they noted that I said scared rather than concerned. I just want
to draw the court's... But you have to be fearful of personal harm, is that right? As opposed to, I'd be startled and I'd tell someone to leave if they shot my house too, but it doesn't mean I would fear personally. It means I don't want them shooting up my house and I want them to get out, right?
Yes.
What do we know here about any personal fear she may have had?
And again, the apprehension can be, it doesn't necessarily have to be fear. It just means you again, the definition is conceive, believe that it could happen. But yes, it's immediate physical injury. I think both the fact that he is, it's not just the fact that he shoots the gun at the ceiling. I think it's the fact that he does so angrily. He's confronting her about her her overnight guest in an angry manner. He then threatens to kill her and her overnight guest. I think that's very good evidence as to that point. But we have her reaction. I think I'm out of time. So if there are no further questions, thank you.
So does he threaten to kill her and her guest?
Yes.
Well, wouldn't that put a reasonable person in fear, or wouldn't put her in fear, even though, couldn't a jury conclude that would have put her in fear?
I don't think so. I think without her testimony or showing her reaction, if Chad testified, and I'm saying the word Chad because I don't know his last name, it's not in the record, but if Chad testified after Mr. Stewart said that she recoiled or she got red in the face or she started breathing heavy, anything like that would have been enough. But there's no testimony in the record as to her reaction when Mr. Stewart said that. And I don't think just the fact that he said that is enough.
Well, but, you know, the law has, criminal law has a million areas where we have to find subjective intent or purpose or belief, and we infer that from external factors which is an inference from what a reasonable person would have meant or believed or had as their purpose in those same circumstances. That's what the inference is.
Well, but I think you have to have some subjective intent. So if you look at the JDB case from the Eastern District, this was a woman who, it's before Halloween, and juveniles have surrounded her car. That would actually make me kind of scared. But she said, no, I had my car doors locked. I was just alarmed. And the Eastern District said alarmed is not the same as apprehension of immediate physical injury. And so they reversed the conviction for that, or the adjudication for that.
Doesn't that create the risk in situations of domestic violence where by the time of trial, someone may well be fearful that if they testify, yes, I was afraid, and the person goes to prison, they will be harmed? People often back out. This is really giving sort of a license for that if they're not willing to testify at trial, then you can't win that case. And in fact, our statutes don't even require cooperation by.
And I think it's always a balancing act, the defendant's rights versus making it too hard to convict someone. And in this case, we're talking about domestic assault in the third degree only. If any physical injury is actually caused, then it's taken from a subjective standard, and the testimony is not necessary, or other reactions on the part of the victim are not necessary. This is domestic assault in the third degree, which is only placing someone in apprehension of immediate physical injury. It is a misdemeanor. I do not believe this would open any kind of floodgates to say the state didn't meet its burden in this case. So I don't believe domestic assault in the first degree or second degree are subjective standards. I believe those are objective standards. It's just in this one case where it is not. I don't believe it will open the floodgates to anything if this court reverses Mr. Stewart's conviction for domestic assault in the third degree. So with that, I would encourage this court to reverse Mr. Stewart's conviction for domestic assault in the third degree, for burglary in the first degree, and for the armed criminal action count associated with that count. Thank you.
Thank you.